I gotta figure out how to function a new audio environment here.
Yeah, I know.
Can you all hear me? Thank you for that welcome. It's always great to be here among friends. For what I've found, and perhaps in contrast to some of the other talks, is really a conversation. I like to give you the benefit of whatever observations I have, but then there's no doubt that what makes these sessions most enjoyable for me and has made them, I guess, a staple of these programs is the chance to have interchange, and especially with healthcare policy so prominent and so many folks whose expertise in the area I defer to, I think we can have a really interesting discussion. The view from Capitol Hill, starting with Congress, that first object and institution you set your eyes on when you're on Capitol Hill. Interesting times for sure. These past few meetings in the Democratic majority, we've observed the strengths and limitations of Nancy Pelosi's leadership style as Speaker, and she continues to be a polarizing figure. And I would say since the last meeting, the public assessment of her and probably the assessment of most folks on the Hill has gotten markedly more skeptical. A turning point in that was the vote in late June, right before the 4th of July recess on the climate change bill. That was a bill that had been crafted by her in close consultation with Henry Waxman on the Energy and Commerce Committee, and reflected very much the priorities of the liberal environmental groups. In the course of getting it out of the committee, extensive deals were cut with certain lobbies that were not exactly liberal environmental stalwarts, the agriculture lobby, the coal lobby, and various other energy lobbies. The product that came out was one that actually left a lot of the rank-and-file environmentalist and more radical environmentalist pretty cold. And you had a few votes in protest on the floor against the bill from Dennis Kucinich, I believe Pete Stark, and maybe Jim McDermott. An extremist fringe, to be sure, but in public discussions, the criticism of the bill was more apparent. And on the flip side, you had a number of the Democrats who came from red state-type districts, districts that Bush or McCain had carried, ran into a lot heavier flack for voting for the bill than they expected. The result was that when they came back after the 4th of July recess, expecting to run head-on into a health care debate, and the expectation from Pelosi had been, we'll pass this health care debate, pass this health care bill during the month of August. Things came a cropper. Blue Dog Democrats in the Energy and Commerce Committee essentially refused to vote for it before the recess, or they said, we'll vote for it before the recess, but only with a promise that it won't move to the floor before the recess. And that upended the timetable that Pelosi and Obama had. So that was one major change, certainly in the last few months. In the perception that Pelosi was acting in a way that was in the best interest of her conference ceased to be the dominant opinion in the conference. And the distinct emergence of an every man for himself kind of mentality started to creep into all the deliberations around contentious issues. And this has been one of the things that I think has undercut Obama, because the House was his muscle. In terms of getting things through the process, Pelosi was his critical agent. And since she's lost her effectiveness, it's no accident you see the health care bill bogging down. Other developments that I would call attention to that have changed the state of play. Guantanamo. Here's an issue that emerged as a presidential promise but ran into serious resistance in Congress, including from the Democrat leadership. By May, and before any noticeable erosion in President Obama's popularity ratings was evident, you had Republicans forcing the Guantanamo issue in both chambers, and you had Democrats running from it. and telling the administration, not just through back channels, but in public statements, you've not given us enough to work with. The prospect of bringing Guantanamo detainees into America, into folks' districts, is something that we can't swallow right now. You need to give us a real plan. The administration was not prepared to give Congress a real plan, and they had a setback. And just these last couple of days, we've seen the reports indicating that, the result is they're not going to be able to keep to their timetable of closing it within a year of Obama's inauguration. And the Post's report, which I believe led the way on this, explicitly characterized it as Obama's first major setback in office. And thinking back on seeing that characterization, it occurred to me that it really is true that up until then, Obama had seemed to be in command, and he had not been stymied in any of his efforts. Since then, everything seems subject to much more vigorous contestation, and the result is that it's one that continues to fester for him. It's one where they still are going to have to get Congress to sign off on a plan, even when they come up with it, and it's only going to get more difficult to resolve that issue going into the election year. You see other issues that illustrate the limits of Obama's command of Congress emerging. The Acorn issue wasn't on anybody's radar screen a month ago, but we all know the story, how basically community organizers, or Alinskyites, let's say, radicals on the right, managed to catch these folks red-handed in the act of behaving like people who don't deserve the extensive taxpayer subsidies that the Democrats wanted to give them. The result, the most recent action on this is surprising, because a lot of people thought the Democrats were supporting legislation to defund Acorn just for show. But last night, in the continuing resolution that will keep the government running past the October 1st deadline, the Democrats inserted an Acorn funding ban. And that was a bill that was put together with very minimal Republican input. In other words, they didn't even let it get to the point where the Republicans had to ask. They preemptively put the Acorn funding ban in the continuing resolution. That's a sign that it's a battle they're choosing not to have. And it reminds me again of what happened with Guantanamo, a preemptive tactical retreat by the Democrats on an issue where they felt like they didn't have the cover. Another issue where you see, I think, emerging trouble is Iran sanctions. This is one where the administration had prevailed on the chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee, Howard Berman, to bottle up Iran sanctions legislation that was supported by groups like the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, AIPAC, all the Jewish community groups, including my own. He sat on it at the administration's behest under the pretense that they were going to give his diplomatic strategy a chance to succeed. Now Berman and Pelosi are saying that they will move that legislation regardless of what the administration wants. I guess you have to watch these kinds of pledges to see if they really mean it, but there is a sense that they've been holding back the pressure for this bill, which is co-sponsored by 312 out of 435 House members, about as long as they can. This is a bill that would impose gasoline sanctions on Iran, cutting off their supply of refined petroleum products, which is seen as a critical, potentially critical economic lifeline, although it may not be enough. They've been making arrangements with Hugo Chavez for gas imports. They've been making arrangements with the Chinese. Apparently, the efficacy of a sanctions strategy is certainly debatable, but the sense that we should be doing at least this has led to a lot of frustration with an administration strategy that said we should do this, but not quite yet. So across a range of issues, you know, these three I ticked off, detainees from Gitmo, Iran sanctions, and Acorn, you see the stirrings of congressional rebellion against the administration, even with a very liberal and very ambitious and controlling leadership under Pelosi. And what it speaks to, I think, is a risk of losing the agenda for the administration. They want to do things that will continue to be problematic, like immigration reform. In this environment, though, there's no reason to think that they'd be able to corral the members of Congress to pass a liberal immigration reform. They want to keep promises to the gay lobbies for bills to repeal the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy and a job discrimination bill and maybe even repeal of the Defense of Marriage Act. There are House members who talk a brave game about passing that measure. None of that can happen, though, if there's this everyman for himself mentality, which is certainly what I've observed increasingly in recent months. And the administration has had to confront this head-on in the health care issue. Again, I'm deferring to policy elements to the more expert folks here who will be following me especially, but just in terms of the political ticking time bombs that are embedded within the health care issue, that to tick them off is to really bring home how difficult the political task that the administration and the congressional leadership have taken on in trying to do this. I made a list off the top of my head. They've got the abortion issue. There's an issue where 20 pro-life House Democrats have said they won't vote for a bill unless, essentially, it passes the National Right to Life Committee's very stringent test of will it or will it not subsidize abortion. And Pelosi, by her own conviction and certainly by her constituency's conviction, is not prepared to give that satisfaction. That's one that'll take some impressive footwork, to say the least, to resolve. The immigration issue, they may have resolved that, but not without taking on, I think, a lot of water in terms of their credibility. Initially, they wanted to pass a program that was liberal in terms of the ease with which illegal aliens could access it. It looks like they've been forced to accept a real verification mechanism, but there's one senator, Menendez of New Jersey, who may throw his body on the line and impede even that thought to be consensus concession to the sentiment in the country. So immigration continues to be a factor to watch. The Medicare issue may be the single most politically perilous facet of the bill, because they are going after these Medicare Advantage plans that one in four seniors is in and overwhelmingly are favored and well-liked by the Medicare beneficiaries who are enrolled in them. This was one where the Republicans in the Finance Committee this week were hitting very hard, and the sensitivities, they're disproportionately located in places where the elderly are numerous, like in Bill Nelson's state of Florida. Nelson is feeling acute cross pressure as a Democrat, but one who notices that his constituents are going to be harmed, and harmed in a very specific way that contradicts Obama's promise of if you like your plan, you can keep your plan. The public option continues to be a political headache for everybody trying to pass this bill, because the left is mobilized around the idea that it's a essential element of the bill, but the administration seems to have decided that they can't pass a bill with the public option. The stories today have Senator Schumer, who by no means is a trivial force on the Hill, saying that he's going to get it in. He says, we may not do it in the Finance Committee, but the prospect is better on the floor, and it's even better in the Conference Committee. So the terrain only looks better and better for us, and we're still determined to do it. For the goal of getting the bill enacted, that's a real problem. The president's pledge to hold it to $900 billion and not add a dime to the deficit really hems in the ambitions of this public plan. If you read the theorists who are most influential in terms of who the administration listened to on the front end, they would say it needed to be $1.2 trillion. Obama, in his speech, saying $900 billion created a lot of pressure to fund a bill that can satisfy their political constituencies without going over his limits. And I guess a similar issue is, how do you pay for it? You have a range of proposals out there as pay-fors that are problematic. The Baucus bill in the Senate uses taxes on so-called high-end insurance plans. It's a twisted kind of tribute to the idea that we should move away from third-party payer, but it comes at the problem indirectly, and it's galvanized opposition from unions. The unions would prefer to see the House approach, which is to just tax the rich, probably a non-starter in the Senate, and it's not clear how that's going to be finessed. Another idea that Obama continues to push for is taxing, reducing the deductions for high earners, charitable mortgage interest and other deductions. That continues to probably also be a non-starter on the Hill. But you see that any of the ideas that have the potential to pay for this bill are deeply vexed, and powerful interests within the Democratic Party are still working very hard to try and defeat them. It keeps on going. Medical malpractice, an issue where Obama is feeling some pressure to try and show flexibility. What he rolled out at his speech on the 9th is not going to get it done. Demonstration projects. Governor Barbour in Mississippi said, "We are the demonstration project. Come look at what we did, and you'll see why we should do this nationally." And another interesting proposal that's out there the administration is sort of stymied by is this idea of allowing interstate purchase of insurance. And David Axelrod was confronted on TV, "Well, why are you against this?" And Axelrod really couldn't say. He hemmed and hawed for about 2 minutes. This is a proposal that does what the administration claims it wants to do, which is have choice and competition. But people credit the administration's rhetoric on choice and competition, even though it's almost certainly dishonest. They want a program that will eliminate choice and competition, but they get the benefit of the doubt from the mainstream media. We end up with a discussion skewed towards their artificial frame for the discussion, but this proposal for interstate purchase of insurance has the potential to give the lie to that pretense, and so it's something that the Republicans may be able to use effectively as a weapon when the legislation goes to the Senate floor. So, you know, to array all these obstacles, you see the kinds of things that can happen when leadership in the White House and the Congress lose control of the political environment. People go freelancing, people start listening to interest groups more and their own leadership in the chamber they serve in less, and you have things that could be done quickly for some reason take a lot longer. And the observation has been made, well, this wouldn't be so complex if they were all behind it. They wouldn't have to spend so much time getting it right if people were ready to vote yes on it. The delay is because of the difficulty and because of the numbers the Democrats have. It's apparent to anyone who pays any kind of attention that they're all internal difficulties. You can't honestly blame the Republicans if you have the Democratic votes to do this. So they've got real problems that are becoming apparent, and it's making a promising environment for next year's election for the Republicans. We've all seen the indicators of that, and probably we'll talk more about it in Q&A, but the question for Republicans is just going to be how to keep it going. And one thing we also didn't talk about so far, the economy. You know, will a change in the economy, if it were to change for the better, this is where I'd like to have Mike Petrino, somebody just say authoritatively, it's not going to change for the better. If unemployment does at least stabilize, we could have a situation where people are so certain that there are going to be continuing rise in the unemployment that even a steady unemployment, get to 10 and stay there, would end up accruing politically to the administration's benefit because a problem that people felt so acutely had stopped getting worse, and that was better than expectations. So the Republicans might not find the environment quite so ideal a year from now as they find it right now. As it is, we're looking very good in the races we have this year in New Jersey and Virginia, but Republicans have to hold it together through next year's campaign, and if they do, we could be looking at a much less unfriendly environment for those of us who want to see conservative policy come 2011. So why don't I leave it there, just having laid out sort of the Hill aspects of it. We can talk about the politics. There were a few other bills that are still floating out there, but it's striking how spare the agenda really is. The administration's trying to get a climate bill. They're trying to get a health care bill. After that, there's not much else. They are struggling to get their budget bills passed, but that's pretty much a fixed facet of congressional life these days. So I think the real question is, you know, does this end up becoming a threat to Pelosi's leadership, whether it's because the Republicans take back the House chamber or because the gains are extensive enough that she's challenged from within her conference. The first victim of electoral victim of Obama's failures could be Pelosi, just based on the electoral cycles. She's facing voters before he is in that sense. So let me leave it there and open that discussion. Yes, sir.
You ended with discussing Pelosi. What's the potential, let's say, the next 6 months that the Democrats could jettison Pelosi?
I don't think that there is much potential for that. They have a liberal majority in the conference. In a way, it's almost like a two-headed monster in the Democratic conference, or a two-headed beast, because you do have this very self-aware group of members that come from McCain and Bush districts. That's 85 members out of a 260-member conference. They're the critical ones in terms of passing contentious legislation. So they have a fairly distinct identity and a fairly distinct set of concerns. But then you have a huge progressive caucus that's organized and claims a lot of very senior folks, confidants of Pelosi, and they are the bulk of the conference. I believe that the progressives have well over 100 out of the 260 members, and they represent the far left pole on anything you could mention, from premature abdication in Iraq and Afghanistan to demanding single payer, demanding a public plan and a health care plan, and saying they won't vote for it without it. They've been fairly aggressive of late. And so the question is, who's going to win their confidence if not Pelosi? Can Pelosi be pushed aside as long as she's strong with that group? She can't. It would take an electoral setback to weaken that group's leverage and create a dynamic where she could be overthrown. Without votes, though, no one's going to take her down.
I had a question, Noah. Just my intuition is that Dick Cheney, speaking out on a couple of occasions regarding national security matters, may have galvanized some of the people on the Hill, emboldened them to speak out, maybe not on that issue, but on others. Have any reaction to that? Is that a misimpression on my part, or what Cheney did is irrelevant? Or?
I think it's really in that kind of vague, ethereal sense that you mentioned, just the sense between the Tea Parties and Cheney speaking out. In some ways, as controversial as it is, Sarah Palin, whose pronouncements continue to get massive amounts of attention. You know, a lot of Republicans are ambivalent about that fact, but it's a fact. The polls don't show people are in love with the Republicans yet, by any stretch of the imagination, but we seem to be winning arguments on the ground. We seem to be preventing the Democrats from consolidating policy gains through, you know, these kinds of fragmentary episodes. So, you know, I think it'd be foolish to discount the significance of anything that really caught the public's attention. When it comes to the Cheney-Obama exchange, my real question is, how much did it catch the public's attention? How many people really tuned in to Obama and Cheney both gave a speech and laid out contrasting visions in the war on terror? I'm not sure how many did. But I think it was helpful to us. However, whoever did tune in, I think it was a helpful thing for us that they did.
And is there one follow-up question? Are there plans to capitalize on the grassroots movement of Tea Parties and whatnot?
I don't think Republicans are sure what to do in that regard, and I'm not sure I know. I think that the energy of the movement, to the extent that that's the right word for it, is vital because it's not associated with the Republican Party. Mm-hmm. And Republicans are smart enough to realize this, that there are certain things you should do. If you're an individual Republican member of Congress, you should go to these events and don't be a stranger to the people who are involved, because they may haze you over something you've done in the past. They probably will. I haven't heard of too many people who can own a Tea Party crowd. But that's part of what makes it seem like something more than just an AstroTurf phenomenon. The Democrats tried to claim it was Fox News, AstroTurf, which was cynical given what has been behind leftist mobilizations that we've seen. But I think unless you were integrally involved and knew on that basis that it wasn't true, I think as a conservative from a distance, you would worry that it was true. I think we've seen enough to know that it wasn't true. There was something organic there. Fox News was riding the wave, and it's great to have a media outlet that does show what's going on in Red America. But it's important that they not be seen as politically compromised, because right now the Republican Party would just drag them down, because we don't have that trust back yet. That's the truth.
Meaning Fox News, the Hannity's and Glenn Beck's.
Because the it's not them. It's the activists at the local level. When you talk about the electoral impact, that's the question. When Tom Price or Lynn Westmoreland show up in an Atlanta area Tea Party, how much does it resemble a Republican pep rally, and how much is it clear that it's a little bit different than a Republican audience, and that the members who come know to an extent that they're visiting someone else's house. They're not in a room of their own. Fox doesn't change that, because Fox is populist, and Fox is not about elected officials and elected offices. Having a media outlet get entangled with it is just a different thing. But Republicans' association with it, if mishandled, could take the fire out of it or discredit it. So that's thought on that.
Reading of the Acorn business as a test. Let's say they might think that the funding bill is going to be struck down as a bill of attainment. That occurred to me, and then I see Barney Frank has signed on to that argument. That's quite plausible. So they think the courts will get them off the hook. They'll have credit for having voted against the state. But do you detect a genuine concern on the Democratic side about Acorn? If so, where did it come from?
Well, it's not genuine outrage. It's out of a sense that this story was getting discussed in those districts. Again, 75 members who have districts that were carried by Bush and McCain. Those were the ones who were bringing their concerns to the Democrat leadership, and those were the ones who I think persuaded the leadership to let the funding bans get a vote and sort out the constitutional stuff later. The point is, don't bleed over this now. But if Acorn ends up losing all their money in it, the Democrats can imagine a lot worse. And I just get the sense, the vulnerable members were really kind of signaling an acute level of distress over these videos. It's amazing how just having a videotape can change the it puts a image on an issue, and it can be surprising to people who deal with these issues mostly in things we read, words. It can really change the political mood when there's a vivid picture.
Have you done the numbers? You must have looked at the numbers to figure what kinds of, how many seats could change. Have you done any kind of estimate or sense of a range of things?
I haven't looked at it seat by seat, and some of it has to do with recruiting, because there are always seats where even in the most favorable political environment, party committees will fail to land an appropriate recruit and come up short. There will be races where we'll get our key recruit, but they'll come up a point or two short on election day just because of who's a better campaigner or things like this. Um, but right now we have every expectation that we're going to recruit pretty well this time. We're going to raise money pretty well this time. All those variables are going to be, if not exactly like a 2006 or a 1994, a year where there was a switch in control, pretty well along the way toward that. And so you start to look at any freshman or sophomore member, you're talking about somebody who's probably fairly lightly entrenched. And again, in a year like that, even members who seemed in the old way of thinking well entrenched don't look so well entrenched anymore. In the Senate, we've got Blanche Lincoln. She's in Arkansas, which is the only state that voted more strongly for the Republican presidential ticket in 2008 than in 2004. And she's suddenly feeling the heat because they're testing her against people nobody's ever heard of, and it's a dead heat. These kinds of changes, you have House members in the same situation, 10-term House members who've laughed off opposition, had the complete luxury of voting liberal, are suddenly seeing themselves in a dead heat against a no-name or generic opponent. So I see a genuine level of concern on the Democrat side. Again, a year can change these things, but right now, the similarities to the years where party control changed are striking enough that that more and more people are treating a House takeover as a plausible scenario. But you're right. Until you've gone seat by seat, until you see how your recruiting has gone, you can't know how plausible it really is. And I think it's clear that that Republicans are going to win that argument in a certain number of seats down south, where Republicans have a freshman. They have freshmen in two Alabama. Democrats have two freshmen in Alabama, and they have one freshman in Mississippi, and another one, I think, they have an open seat in Louisiana that they've been holding. All these are they're going to flip. The question is, can Republicans carry that with success into the Ohios, the less red-complected states, the Republican voting districts in those states, and that would make the difference between whether they could really threaten control of the chamber or not. Nick, you've had your hand up every time.
Things as expected are happening with the Democrats. We're seeing their popularity get severely reduced as their policies become more clear than what's going on to the American people. But you're also seeing the Republicans staying equally unpopular, and even more so, in an unprecedented way. And the question that the Republican Party needs to grasp is that there's a growing frustration in the base of the Republican Party is, are the Republicans who we are in the job going to actually implement the principles and the policies that they're supposed to stand for? Because there is a real sense in our country, and even more so felt with the economic crisis world, that there is a need for fundamental change, not Obama's kind of change, but fundamental change, because we cannot tolerate the growth of government and the kind of policies of both Democrat and Republican that we've condoned for 30 years without it having a severely, almost apocalyptically destructive effect on our economy. And the issue for the Republicans is, even if we win the election, even if it goes back to the Republicans in the choice between two evils, and we get another George Bush elected or a Romney or a Clinton, and we get the same kind of policies economically that Bush implemented, the same kind of compromises, will that guy come out at the end of his office more unpopular than Bush was? Because he never really implemented the policies that really are what the Republican Party should be about, and that when they bring the results that they have the potential to could really be popular with the American people?
I would say that the dynamic of a debate that's in a presidential cycle that's going to be defined by the question, should we fire this guy? And a congressional cycle that's going to be mostly, should we hem this guy in? Should we hedge this guy? Is not going to be an environment where the Republican Party is going to feel a lot of inherent motivation to debate first principles. And you saw what the Democrats did. They put off all the divisions in their party, and they just concentrated on being ready when people decided they wanted to fire the other guys. So I think with each passing day, that's going to be more and more where the energy in the party is, being ready to have power handed back to us to the extent we can run campaigns strong enough to get it. I don't see a lot of first principles debate. To an extent, personnel is policy, and to an extent, primaries in districts can be the venue for these kinds of debates. We talked about the Kentucky Senate race, where there's probably going to be that kind of a dynamic. That's the way it should be all the time. I'm not sure that Republicans beyond that want to open that kind of thing up. I think it's really just about trying to get out there and win some elections. Does that sound too callous? No. Yeah.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about the Tea Party people. I'm ambivalent about the whole phenomenon because on the one hand you sort of welcome the civic spirit and vigilance and say there's sort of eruption of grassroots. But my fear is that a lot of this is the old sort of Paratista sentiment, kind of anti-political, populist in the sense that many of the people associated with the Tea Party movement don't make distinctions between effective governance, a better or worse course of action, or kind of indiscriminate denunciation of politics or government. And my fear is that's the same kind of sentiment that gave us Jesse Ventura in Minnesota, and millions of people voted for a deranged guy for president in 1992. And so it's a difficult challenge for the Republican Party on the one hand to be open to that sentiment and try to channel it for constructive political purposes. On the other hand, it does seem to me that there can be a kind of indiscriminate populist sentiment that's has some pitfalls of its own along the lines I just suggested. So I don't quite know how a prudent and savvy Republican Party comes to terms with that without maintaining a sense of balance.
Because those people are voting, they're not necessarily leading. It seems just off the top of my head like the conscientious way for Republicans to approach the Tea Party movement. I agree with your premise that you wouldn't want to govern on the basis of a lot of the stuff that they treat as axiomatic. But at the same time, it can be a wholesome energy. I think it is a wholesome energy. So the appropriate posture, it seems to me, for Republican elected officials is engage with it respectfully. Only make promises that you can expect to keep to these folks. If you're straight up, you'll beat the Democrats, because right now, you couldn't pay these people to vote for Democrats anyway. You just have to be, I would say this, the example is what Gingrich did. He put the Parotista energy to work in electing a Republican majority. He only made promises to them that he was prepared to keep. It meant that some promises didn't get on the list that many of us on a few different issue spectrums would have liked to have seen, but he didn't have to break faith. We ran into other problems governing as a Republican majority, but a bunch of people saying, you promised to do X, Y, and Z in the 94 elections and didn't do it except on term limits. I think people appreciated the Republicans did keep the platform they ran on. I think we can reach that kind of accommodation with Tea Party populists now the same way, roughly.
Let's just take one more.
Okay.
At the very edge. Steve, you had something?
I just had a footnote. Purely local level, I think the Tea Party needs to be taken very seriously. They've been around for some time in Minnesota, and they are very active in local elections, school board elections, and they are emphatically anti-tax. That is their cause, and they are totally irrational or something.
And Minnesota is a state that has both the highest voter turnout and is willing, over the long term, you can see, to elect Republicans. High voter turnout doesn't have to be fatal. Minnesota proves this. Jesse Ventura raised turnout. That's the potential of this Tea Party movement, to happen in 1994, to raise turnout in the Republican voting cohort and really change the makeup of the electorate in a way so it would almost be the opposite of the 2008 electorate, which was so strongly Democrat. That's where you start to see the possibility of real breakthrough gains for our party, but I'm not sure that the fundamentals of money and candidates will necessarily leave us. Look at a state like yours. We're not going to challenge Tim Walz probably seriously. I think there are a few other Democrats who are going to get a pass. We're going to be protecting Michelle Bachmann. There are enough different states where the weakness of the Republican Party that continues to be a problem will probably keep us from taking full advantage. But the Tea Party right now, I guess what it comes down to is that's the best thing we've got going for us.
Let me just add something to in closing. I'm going to bring you and Nick closer together. I don't think there's quite, you may think there's more of a distance here. Kim Stossel had this piece in the Wall Street Journal, probably yesterday, saying, holding up McDonald in Virginia. And here's the policy. You mute all those so-called social conservative, which is, say, moral questions, and you put the accent on roads and things of this kind. This is the formula. So your understanding of a conservative party is a party that makes its success by refusing to articulate in public anything of moral consequence. And that's your understanding of what a conservative party is. Now, that's not the one that I think you hold out. You don't hold out. You've always been very active on those questions in the Hill, and in cultivating that circle of people in the Hill. So, just to finish the response to Nick, you think is it only in the primaries that those kinds of issues can be articulated? Could you not see a presidential election where these things could be made accessible? What's your own sense of the best place to put prospects?
Maybe I was reading more into it than was warranted. From talking to Nick, I think that the question you were really driving at was a kind of a trade and manufacturing economic reassessment of the kind of liberalism and free trade.
I was talking about both, really.
Yeah.
Any articulation, but not just trade and economics.
Yeah, no, like I said in the subsequent answers, the Republicans have to go to where the passion is in the electorate. And to the extent that there's people who have vehement, serious concerns about the decline of manufacturing, the cost of free trade, the Republican Party is going to have to develop a way to speak to them. And if the place that leads is a full-on debate between people who want to be more less economically liberal versus people who want to stay relatively economically liberal. I wouldn't mind having that debate. I don't know that it's going to be a debate that the energy, the trajectory of political events is necessarily going to force us to have. Does that make more sense?
Yeah. Right. Thanks so much, Noah. That's great.